Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's White House meeting between President Biden and Iraq's Prime Minister al-Sudani to discuss the future of U.S. troops in a country heavily influenced by Iran, with the possibility of an Israeli escalation in response to Iran's drone and missile attack, putting U.S. military personnel in Iraq and Syria in danger from Iranian retaliation. Joining us is Adam Weinstein, the Deputy Director of the Middle East Program at the Quincy Institute and a former combat veteran who served with the Marines in Afghanistan and previously worked as a senior law and policy analyst at the National Iranian American Council. He has a forthcoming brief from the Quincy Institute, Troops in Peril, the Risk of Keeping U.S. Troops in Iraq and Syria. Then we'll assess the first day of Trump's so-called hush money trial in New York and get an analysis of how strong the legal case is against the former president who paid off a porn star to avoid further electoral damage following the Access Hollywood tape that came out just before the 2016 elections. Joining us is Jennifer Taub, a legal scholar and professor of law at Western New England School of Law, whose writing focuses on corporate governance, banking and financial market regulation, white-collar crime and corruption, and she's testified as a banking law expert before Congress, and her latest book is Big Dirty Money, Making White-Collar Criminals Pay, now out in paperback. And she's the host of the new podcast, Booked Up with Jen Taub. Then finally, we'll examine the vulnerability of election workers who are quitting in record numbers as Trump continues to claim they helped steal the last election from him, with Speaker Johnson joining in the big lie on Friday at Mar-a-Lago to fix a non-existent problem of election integrity. Joining us is Joshua Farrar, a PhD candidate in political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, who researches American politics, methods, racial and ethnic politics, and comparative politics. He is the co-author of a new report at UCLA and the Bipartisan Policy Center, which we will discuss, Election Official Turnover Rates from 2000 to 2024. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Adam Weinstein, who is the Deputy Director of the Middle East Program at the Quincy Institute and a former combat veteran who served with the Marines in Afghanistan. And he has a forthcoming brief from the Quincy Institute, Troops in Peril, the Risk of Keeping U.S. Troops in Iraq and Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Weinstein.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And today, President Biden is meeting with the Iraqi Prime Minister al-Sudani in the White House, and clearly, even though they're talking about U.S. troops in Iraq and the Iraqi pressure and Iranian pressure to get them out, I'm assuming there'll be a lot of discussion about the recent Iranian missile and drone strike on Israel and the extent to which many of those missiles and drones flew over Iraq. I think one or two were shot down by a U.S. Patriot missile battery in Erbil in the Iraqi Kurdistan. But given that al-Sudani in many ways was put into power by Iranian Shia militias operating inside of Iraq, what do you expect to happen in today's White House meetings?
Well, look, I'd be surprised if they have some very actionable announcement about a troop withdrawal. Maybe they'll come up with some kind of timeline. I actually think the Iraqi government in some ways likes to have its cake and eat it too when it comes to U.S. troops. They don't want U.S. troops to conduct drone strikes in the country or violate its sovereignty even after they come under attack. But at the same time, they do like the benefits of U.S. troops so far as intelligence, targeting capabilities. And I think a lot of stakeholders in the Iraqi government and the Iraqi elites also believe that so long as U.S. troops are in Iraq, the United States will continue to support Iraq financially. I think, the long-term solution is probably that there'll be some rotating training missions in which U.S. troops, temporarily train Iraqi forces in very, very, very small numbers, but that the vast majority of the 2,500 U.S. troops do leave Iraq.
And Adam, you wrote a piece recently, just after the Israeli strike on Iran's consulate in Damascus, Syria, concerned that the Israeli strike would shatter a month-long ceasefire between the U.S. troops and Iran's aligned militias in Iraq and Syria, and that truce came about after the drone killed the three U.S. service people in Jordan. It's still holding, right, even after the recent shower of missiles coming from Iran into Israel, which you have to admit there was a certain theatrical quality to it, given that the Iranian mission at the United Nations in New York released a statement saying that, as in fact the Iranians said just as they had launched the missiles, that they're on their way. It's like they almost gave the US and the coalition and the Israelis the heads up. But the mission at the UN in New York released a statement at that time saying that they had responded to the Israeli strike on Damascus and the matter can be deemed concluded. And now, of course, we're on tenterhooks because we're not sure that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu considers the matter deemed concluded. So it's clear that the Iranians have satisfied their hardliners. Even if it's a symbolic and theatrical attack, as I've described it, they're also holding back, pulling the trigger on Hezbollah and other assets they have, and it could get so much worse if Israel takes the bait. Do you agree with that situation?
Yeah, I agree that Israel shouldn't take the bait. I mean, if I was Netanyahu right now, I would actually be happy that the prestige of the IDF has been restored to some degree, and that they were able to intercept, almost all of the missiles and drones that were launched. They, at least momentarily look like a professional military again. Attention has been taken off of Gaza. You see ministries of foreign affairs around the world that, 24 and 48 hours prior to the Iranian strike had been criticizing Israel, were all of a sudden condemning the attack and saying that they stood with Israel 100%. I think that's, on the world stage, a good situation for Israel and Netanyahu, and perhaps they should let sleeping dogs lie. The problem is that Netanyahu is a politician, and there's the folks in his cabinet who they don't want this to be the new norm. They don't want to establish a new norm in which it's acceptable for Iran to launch retaliatory strikes against Israel from Iranian soil, which hasn't really occurred in the past. So they might feel a need to respond. I think that's short-sighted. I think they risk opening a northern front with Hezbollah. I think the Biden administration should do everything it possibly can to restrain the Israeli government. But, from Netanyahu's perspective, especially dealing with a domestic audience, and given the hawkishness of his war cabinet, I could see a scenario where they do respond in an escalatory way.
Well, surely Netanyahu's situation is that the longer he stays in power and keeps this war in Gaza going, and perhaps even expands it even wider, the more chance he has of staying in power and staying out of jail. So he has a pretty fundamental dog in this fight, doesn't he?
He does. And look, this has been one of the risks of, I think, in some ways, the Biden administration hasn't laid it all out on the field in terms of using U.S. leverage to try to secure some kind of ceasefire in Gaza, which could have scaled down tensions. The risk of allowing this conflict to continue is that more and more of these unpredictable events can occur. And so we saw that with the Israeli strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. And so what you have right now is Iran and Israel playing chicken with each other. That's a very dangerous game.
So, we mentioned the Patriot Battery in Erbil shooting down an Iranian ballistic missile overflying Iraq on its way to Israel. And but apparently most of the serious weapons, the fast-moving ballistic missiles, were taken down by U.S. and coalition forces in Jordan, the British and the French, etc. So is that any leverage over Netanyahu? Like, you know, I think Biden's made it clear that if there's a escalation on the part of Israel and they retaliate against the Iranian missile and drone strike, then the U.S. and the coalition won't be there to help them out.
Well, I think it should be leveraged. I think the Biden administration should remind Netanyahu that the reason Israel has these capabilities is because of the United States, and it does cost the U.S. taxpayer. And of course, the United States is also involved in weapons transfers that have enabled the war in Gaza. So I actually think we have quite a bit of leverage. One thing I would remind listeners, though, is I think there can be sometimes be this assumption that these attacks that occur on U.S. troops by Iran-backed militias, or these attacks that can occur by Iran on Israel, can just be, we can use our superior technology, you know, U.S. technology to prevent these from being effective. But all it takes is one lucky shot. And we saw that at Tower 22 in Jordan at the end of January. So the fact is U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria and in the region are at significant risk so long as these tensions are escalating.
So back to today's White House meeting between Iraq's Prime Minister al-Sudani and Biden, given the role of the U.S. Patriot Battery in Erbil and it's a multinational presence there in Erbil, what would happen, do you think, Adam Weinstein, if the United States was told to leave? The Iranians really want that. But wouldn't the Kurds be vulnerable both to Turkey and to Iran? And it's worth noting that, of course, al-Sudani, after he leaves the White House, is going to be meeting with the Turkish dictator, Erdogan.
Well, I think the Kurds would be vulnerable in some ways, in that they would be, less politically influential in the federal system that exists. Of course, you know, there is some risk of ISIS as well. But, you know, I really don't think that the Iraqi government is going to explicitly tell the U.S. to leave. I actually think that's going to be a decision that's made in Washington. I think they might tell the U.S. to leave in principle and to leave at some date in the future. But I actually think in many ways the Iraqi government is having its cake and eating it too, getting the benefits of U.S. troops. You know, when it comes to actually having them leave, I'm not sure it's Baghdad that's going to pull the trigger on that. It's Washington that should. And the reason it should is because the risks that are mitigated by U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria, such as enabling partner forces to contain ISIS and so forth, and to some degree being able to monitor Iranian activities, are vastly outweighed by the risk of escalation should a significant number of U.S. troops be killed. I mean, in the case of Jordan, it didn't really escalate. But if more U.S. troops had been killed, it might have. Or if we had a different U.S. president, it might have.
So if Israel attacks, retaliates against Iran, then U.S. troops in Syria and Iraq become hostages?
Well, in effect, I mean, there's not a guarantee that they would be targeted, but they may be targeted. And if they are targeted and they're killed, then you can see that there's a serious risk of the United States being pulled into a regional war between Israel and Iran in a way that's not beneficial to the United States. And of course, that risk is elevated in an election year when President Biden needs to show strength due to domestic political reasons. And of course, Trump is going to criticize him if he doesn't show strength. And you'll see all kinds of calls coming out of Congress. In fact, after the attack on Tower 22, you saw members of Congress basically saying we should conduct strikes inside Iran. So you can see that, you know, this isn't just a matter of international relations. This is international relations that is supercharged by domestic politics in all of the countries involved. The domestic politics of Israel, the domestic politics of Iran, and the domestic politics of the United States. And that's a very dangerous situation.
And you've got the former Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, going on TV listing a whole bunch of targets he wants to be blown up in Iran. So But what about the Iranian leadership, the Ayatollahs? They've always had three goals. One, to evict the United States from the Middle East. Two, to replace Israel with Palestine. And three, bring down the U.S.-led world order. And they've been pretty effective at using their proxies, going back to the 1980s, blowing up the U.S. embassy in Beirut, and the U.S. Marines there, forcing Reagan to pull them out, etc. And then you can go through the Iraq War. Of course, that was our stupidity. And Iran was the only winner of the Iraq War, but the U.S. did pay a price with Iranian IEDs killing a lot of Americans. So this is not a good neighborhood to be in if Iran decides to escalate.
Well, look, the primary goal of Iran's leaders and its system is to stay in power. Those other goals that you mentioned are secondary to that, and they're ideological goals in some ways. And you do see Iran responding in a calibrated way. Iran basically telegraphed that it was going to conduct these strikes on Israel. Israel had hours to prepare. The leaders in Iran likely knew that it wouldn't be effective. Of course, as you labeled it, it was theatrical. The problem is that Israel, Iran, the United States, in a regional conflict like this, the risk of miscalculation, the risk of going too far, the risk of not understanding what the intention is of the other actor, and of course, the reality, which I keep going back to, is that domestic politics is shaping some of these responses. Netanyahu has to be strong. Biden has to be strong. The Iranian government needs to respond to the fact that they're a senior general and their consulate is targeted. So it's an unpredictable situation. And when we have U.S. troops in the region, they do become hostage to these unpredictable flare-ups. So what I'd say is it would probably be better not to have U.S. troops, not probably, it would be better not to have U.S. troops indefinitely stationed in Syria and Iraq, in which they can be targeted. And of course, I think the Biden administration should do everything it can do to restrain Israel right now from escalating this further. And of course, that doesn't take Iran off the hook. But the reality is that Washington has far more influence over Israel than it does over Iran.
Well, Adam, though, that seems to be debatable. Recently, the former vice president running mate of Hillary Clinton's in 2016, Senator Tim Kaine, said that Netanyahu played Biden after the October 7th brutal attack by Hamas on Israel, and that Biden knows he's being played. I mean, in a way, the Iranians are being the more sober and rational player at the moment. Israel is unpredictable because, as we mentioned earlier, of Netanyahu's political situation, where he's invested in this Gaza war to keep it going and even to expand it further, because he stays in power and stays out of jail. So that's what I think is more concerning, isn't it? That we don't quite know. And the war cabinet that you mentioned is very hawkish, but is there a possibility that Benny Gantz could walk out of the war cabinet? Is there any domestic pressure? I mean, Netanyahu is incredibly unpopular in Israel itself. Can the Israeli people weigh in against the tail that wags the dog, this far-right government?
Well, look, I'm going to say something that folks in Washington and New York, for that matter, don't say too often, which is that I am not an expert on domestic Israeli politics such that I can give an extremely nuanced answer about that. I do think there's pressure within Israel. You do see the protests. There are risks of the coalition, of Netanyahu's coalition, breaking apart. Of course, it could break apart because he's not hardline enough. So there's risks in both directions. But I do think the United States does have leverage over Netanyahu and should exercise it. It is true that Netanyahu views this entire situation as an existential threat to his political career, and he's demonstrated that he is willing to make decisions that prioritize his own political career, perhaps over the security of Israel. In fact, I'd go as far to say that the chaos, the political and divisive chaos that Netanyahu subjected Israel to might have been part of the reason that they missed all the warning signs of October 7th to begin with. It was a state that was incredibly distracted because of Netanyahu's antics. So I agree, Netanyahu is a wild card, but even more reason not to give him free rein to do whatever he wants.
Well, Adam Weinstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Weinstein, who's the Deputy Director of the Middle East Program at the Quincy Institute and a former combat veteran who served with the Marines in Afghanistan. And he previously worked as a senior law and policy analyst at the National Iranian American Council. And his forthcoming brief from the Quincy Institute is Troops in Peril, the Risk of Keeping U.S. Troops in Iraq and Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and back, assessing the first day of Trump's so-called hush money trial in New York, and get an analysis of how strong the legal case is against the former president who paid off a porn star to avoid further electoral damage following the Access Hollywood tape that came out just before the 2016 election.
Well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. So come on and let me know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jennifer Taub, who's a legal scholar and professor of law at Western New England School of Law. Her writing focuses on corporate governance, banking and financial markets regulation, white-collar crime and corruption. She has testified as a banking law expert before Congress, and her latest book is Big Dirty Money, Making White-Collar Criminals Pay, now out in paperback. And she's the host of the new podcast, Booked Up with Jen Taub. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be on.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jennifer. And the first day of Trump's so-called hush money trial happened today. And actually, Trump appeared to fall asleep a few times. I don't know whether that was theater or he was tired or not. But they've got a pretty substantial jury pool, about 96 people. I think half of them had said that they couldn't be impartial. Then a few more had other reasons why they couldn't be on the jury. So do you think you can get a jury that's fair and impartial and that doesn't have a Trump plant? Because after all, the co-defendant in the We Build the Wall trial with Steve Bannon, a guy who was a real Trumpster and, of course, a con man as well, they fleeced Trump supporters out of quite a lot of money, which both Bannon and this guy, Timothy Shea, pocketed. And that jury had a Trumpster on it, and which is why Shea got off. Just the one person out of 12 was enough. And this guy apparently frustrated the jurors to the point where they complained to the judge. But for some reason or other, she didn't do anything about it. And it ended in a mistrial. So there's a precedent there of how if you get one person on the jury that's a Trumpster, he'll get acquitted.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I know that the defense in this case is going to get, I think, maybe 10 peremptory challenges, which is just sort of the no-cause challenges. I'm not sure how many peremptory challenges the prosecution gets. Let's assume it's only 10. That may just not be enough, right? I mean, you try to, you know, the judge is conducting the voir dire where he's asking questions and trying to discern whether jurors will be biased, even if they claim they will not. Either biased, you know, you want jurors who are going to listen to the facts and the law, look at the continents of the various witnesses and come to a conclusion fairly. And to figure that out, you ask various questions. And as you noted, in the first batch of 96, half of them said they could not be fair. Now, it's quite possible that some of them said that upon hearing the trial was going to be 6 weeks long, and that was their way out. But there are always people who are gunning to be on the jury, maybe because they want to convict and they don't want to hear the evidence, or others who, you know, are ride or die, you know, Trump fans, and they basically, no matter what, want to acquit, and you try to make sure you have removed them. But that's why there are these peremptory challenges where, for no cause at all, you can say, you know, that guy, you know, I want him out. I just look, or that gal, I don't want her on the jury. And you can do that for any cause except for discriminatory ones, you know, as a result of, you know, Supreme Court decisions and obviously equal protection under the Constitution.
So although this is referred to as a hush money trial, the reality is that those kind of charges would only result in a misdemeanor, and that the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg needs to get a felony. So he said that the Trump's organization records were falsified to conceal or aid criminal activity, but he's never specified the exact crime that's allegedly hidden here. And essentially, it's not clear that a state prosecutor can invoke federal election crime, which appears to be what Bragg intends to bring.
Let me just be clear, having looked at the original filings and the press release in a connection with this case, just to back up as a law professor, the charges, you're right, in this case are, there's 34 of them, 34 counts of falsifying business records in the first degree, which is essentially the same thing as falsifying business records as a misdemeanor, with that added piece that the intent, that you had an intent to commit another crime or conceal one. Now, just to refresh your memory and my memory as I say this, you know, Alan Weisselberg pleaded guilty in the under the table payments that were also tax fraud a couple of years ago, and the Trump organization itself, you know, doing, you know, these two corporations out of New York were doing business as a Trump organization, were found guilty by a jury, and those charges were the misdemeanor falsifying business records, right? Now, you said, you know, to make this a felony, you have to have that intent to commit another crime. And in the original documents, the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, did suggest that those were federal or state election interference. So that was, you know, that was out there initially, you know, but he doesn't, what's tricky here is you don't actually have to prove election fraud. It's kind of like, you know, if you enter into a conspiracy to do something, to commit murder, a conspiracy to defraud the United States, or conspiracy to file a false tax return, et cetera, you can be convicted of the conspiracy even if you didn't fulfill the crime. And they don't have to prove all the elements of the crime. They just have to prove you had entered into agreement and taken a step in furtherance of that plan with an, you know, with another person, that agreement. So it's similar here. First, they have to prove falsifying of business records, and then they have to just show what his intent was. So they just have to show that he was trying to do it to interfere in the election in some way. That's going to be the harder part, because he, you know, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt to prove that intent. And his main argument is going to be, I wanted to hide these sexual dalliances from my beloved third wife, and that could be compelling to people.
So in other words, a state prosecutor can invoke federal election law without having to necessarily prove it. Is that what you're saying? As long as
there's never been a case on that. In other words, Alvin Bragg is talking about state election law and federal election law. Remember, state election law also applies to federal elections, because these elections, people mm-hmm. voted in New York. Right. Sure. And so, you know, I think they're doing both, and you better believe there'll be appeals on that question.
And didn't Mark Pomerantz muddy the water or give Trump's lawyers some kind of leeway there? He often referred to the investigation as the zombie case, because he wrote a book about it, which wasn't particularly helpful after he'd resigned.
You know, I think at the end of the day, there's what the public thinks, and then there's going to be what courts think, right? And just because one prosecutor has a different view of the law, the bottom line, what's going to matter is this jury And if he's convicted, the appellate court, as well as then the highest court in New York, which is New York Court of Appeals, funnily enough, because this is the Supreme Court where they have the trials. But, you know, at the end of the day, that particular question about federal law as opposed to state law, you know, might be one for an appeal. But we haven't even, you know, that's, we still have, you know, to pick a jury and get through 6 weeks of trial without some kind of chaos and mistrial. So it should be interesting.
And the judge reminded Trump at the end of today's hearing that he has to show up every day for the next 6 weeks, right?
Mm.
Or go to prison if he doesn't.
I had not heard that part. Yeah. I just know that it doesn't, juries don't love, well, there's two things. Juries don't love with the defendant is falling asleep. And then, of course, I'm sure you heard that when he opened his eyes, they were red and bloodshot. Which he, you know, he was not happy when Maggie Haberman of the New York Times published that, and apparently he glared at her when he saw her in the courtroom. I know in his second trial, the E. Jean Carroll, the second trial based on the first count of the first time he defamed her when he was president, you know, he started yelling in court. You know, I don't know how he's going to contain himself without heavy sedation, which may explain why he was sleepy.
So it's possible that he was sedated in order to suppress his instincts?
It could be, but that's going to be a big political problem because he's always making fun of everyone else for seeming too old and not awake. So I think he's going to err on the side of alertness tomorrow, and that may be a big problem for him. It's kind of his Scylla and Charybdis. Is he so doped up? I mean, I have no idea. Okay, this is hypothetical. I don't know whether he was on medication, but imagine if you're trying to sedate him like you sedate my dog who gets groomed so he doesn't freak out. If his lawyers are trying to sedate him, but he falls asleep, that's bad. But if he's actually fully awake, he may become rabid. So that's his Scylla and Charybdis. We shall see.
Well, in today's back and forth, right out of the gate, of course, Trump's lawyers tried to throw out the entire case, and they were quickly shut down based upon the allegations that somehow the judge's daughter is in the bag for the Democrats, and he quickly shut that down. But the one thing that they did seem to win on, Trump's lawyers, was on the Access Hollywood tape, which is not going to be shown to the jury. I believe a transcript might be shown. What do you know about that,
Jen?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, so the rules of evidence are something that it's a balancing test. You want to allow the prosecutor and the defense to bring in any evidence that is relevant. But sometimes things are too prejudicial to be probative, they say. So instead of allowing for the actual videotape or audio tape from Access Hollywood, if they allow the transcripts as well as, which is, you know, the content of it, the jury would then find out what he said, as well as, you know, maybe Hope Hicks or anyone who was around, I don't know if she was around in the campaign, but any campaigners, maybe Kellyanne Conway, if you have people testify or look at their emails, where they said, oh my God, this is the worst thing. We've got to do something about this. Because what they're trying to show is that the payoff to Stormy Daniels happened a day after the Access Hollywood tape leaked. And so it was campaign motivated as opposed to my beloved third wife motivated, right? So yes, they're not going to let the video be seen, but it's quite possible that every single juror has already seen that. And that would not be disqualifying in and of itself. But just talking about it, I think would be enough. And I think it's a very smart move on the judge's behalf to make that balance. We'll let the evidence come in, but not the sensationalized part that is not really relevant to what this what this trial's about.
But Jen, does this mean that that Trump's beloved third wife, Melania, could be a witness on his behalf, saying how devastated she was to learn while she was pregnant that he was having sex with a porn star?
You know, I don't know if she is going to be one of the witnesses. What I do know is the judge has only given Trump's team 48 hours to come to give all of their all the documents, all the evidence that they're planning to introduce for the defense or something. I'm trying to remember exactly what he said. They were trying to drag that out, saying they didn't have time. And he said, you know, you filed two Rule 78 motions over the weekend. That's like to try to disqualify him. So the judge is not buying it. But I think we're going to know more once I don't know if we're going to know what that is. But I do know, I think we're going to know a lot. Well, let me say this other thing. The judge also was very clear with Trump's lawyer, saying you are not allowed in opening arguments to say Donald Trump will say X unless you're 100% sure he's planning to testify. So you're not allowed to say what he'll say unless that's the case. So instead of him trying to, we will know in opening arguments maybe a few days from now or next week, depending on how long jury selection takes, whether he is testifying. Or, I'm sorry, not, we'll know if he's, if they don't mention what he's going to say, that means he's not sure if he's testifying. If they say Donald Trump will say X, then we know he is. And, you know, again, if they don't say that, then he's being a coward and he's not sure what he's going to do. He should make a decision one way or another.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, do you think, I mean, the judge did lay out the prosecution's case, and they seem to have a strong one in terms of having the National Enquirer people explain that they had a process going in this election, and they actually communicated with the Trump campaign to do catch and kill. And of course, one of the stories that they kept off the headlines, she's going to be showing up, right, to Karen McDougal as a witness. So it seems like they can build the foundation, can't they, to this case.
So, Ian, if you were on the jury, I'm sure you know, and you saw this evidence, I know what you would do. But I can tell you there are, 12 people who decide. And anyone who is not actually in the courtroom looking at their faces would be lying to you if they were trying to predict what would happen. It's all about those jurors watching their faces during trial. So if I wanted to predict what was going to happen, I would watch them. I would watch who they were looking at. I would watch whether they were asleep. I would watch them. And if I can't do, because they're the deciders, right? That's the bottom line. It doesn't matter how strong the government's case is. What matters is what evidence they react to. Right. And what witnesses are brought on, how do they do? How are the witnesses? But the case looks very strong to me if they have an honest jury.
Right. And that is, just in closing, that is a question which I raised earlier, because the co-defendant with Stephen Bannon when they ripped off the We Build a Wall suckers who gave them money, which they pocketed, there was one Trumpster on that jury that acquitted Bannon's, hung the jury and caused a mistrial. So.
Yep.
It's a possibility. I thank you for joining us, Jen. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Taub, who's a legal scholar and professor of law at Western New England Law School, whose writing focuses on corporate governance, banking and financial markets regulation, white-collar crime and corruption. She has testified as a banking law expert before Congress, and her latest book is Big Dirty Money, Making White-Collar Criminals Pay, now out in paperback. And she's the host of the new podcast, Booked Up with Jen Taub. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the vulnerability of election workers who are quitting in record numbers as Trump continues to claim they helped steal the last election. It's like being on trial for your life with a public defender. Let the jury fill the seats up and start the court calendar off with docket number 9mm. All rise, the Honorable Jay-Z preside. Instead of a mallet, I hold a tool. All objections overruled. Save your opening arguments. Hope you understand it. Two guns, right over left. That's how I cross-examine. Like Tom Cruise, popping with the top gun. You lose. No lie, and y'all can't handle the truth. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Joshua Farrar, who is a PhD candidate in political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, who researches American politics, methods, racial and ethnic politics, and comparative politics. He's the co-author of a new report at UCLA and the Bipartisan Policy Center, Election Official Turnover Rates from 2000 to 2024. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Farrar.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So Joshua, on Friday, new Speaker Mike Johnson met with Trump down in Mar-a-Lago, and they had a press conference together announcing a election integrity bill, which is based upon a complete the unreality that goes back to Trump's 2016 election, when he explained the loss of 3 million popular votes to Hillary Clinton, that over 3 million invisible Mexicans voted. And that is now become a core belief, and that's now expanded into this idea that Republicans have, that millions of undocumented vote for Democrats, and that's why the Democrats have the so-called open border, so that immigrants can flood in from the South and immediately become voters for the Democrats, which is complete lie, total fantasy, completely untrue. But nevertheless, that's what both Speaker Johnson and Trump have come up with. So how is that going to impact the work that you're doing about how election workers are being harassed and driven out of office?
Yeah, it's very worrying, and it's only going to make it worse. It seems pretty clear from what happened that Trump's playbook in 2016 and again in 2020 is just going to happen again, where these false claims that the election is stolen are going to invigorate many people who are willing to harass and give angry messages and disrupt the election process. And it means that, you know, we need to do everything we can to support those people who are running our elections, who are facing the brunt of this harassment, and who are under-resourced and underappreciated. So, you know, it's a worrying sign, but we need to do everything we can to make sure that those workers who are ensuring that we have free and fair elections can continue to do so in this election.
But given that Trump, ever since he was defeated in the last election, has managed to get an enormous number of Americans to believe that he won that election and that President Biden is an illegitimate president. So the Stop the Steal lie has metastasized into a core belief amongst most Republicans. So if you believe that the last election was fraudulent and stolen, doesn't that therefore make election workers thieves?
Yes, that's the concern. And we've heard from election officials across the country that they've been facing unprecedented amounts of harassment and threats. So it's not just that people are holding these beliefs, but they're taking action against the officials who are charged and tasked with running America's elections. And a lot of them are leaving because of the threats and harassment they're getting. So there's been a few reports previously trying to look at how many are leaving. There's been headlines over the past several months and several years that these concerns have arisen. But there hasn't been a full deep look into, are they actually leaving at higher rates? Is this a new phenomenon? Is this a phenomenon that's been going on for a couple of decades? Because there's been attacks on the integrity of U.S. elections, not just in the past few years, but in the past few decades. And so we look at administrative data to see are election officials leaving at higher rates over the past 24 years? And the answer clearly is yes. Back in 2004, only about 20% of election officials who administered the 2004 presidential election were different than those who administered the 2000 election. And we see this increase over time, which is fairly dramatic, to the point where in 2022, about 39% of election officials who had administered the 2018 midterms left their positions and were replaced by new people in 2022. And we do see a pretty big spike just in the past few years. So in 2018, about 33% of election officials were different from 4 years prior. In 2020, it was 34%, and then it has jumped to 39% in 2022. And it's too early to tell just how many have left over the past 4 years from 2020, but it also looks like a high number.
So the methodology in terms of your exploration of election official turnover from 2000 to 2024 involved 18,644 local chief election officials across 6,290 jurisdictions in all 50 states, right?
That's correct. Yeah, this is my knowledge. I can be pretty confident in saying it's the largest such collection of election officials ever undertaken.
So, is this though a strategy? In other words, I'm going back to the Stop the Steal lie, which is, has caught on obviously in a big way, and by extension, if you're saying that the election system in this country is crooked and the wrong guy got elected in the last time around, then how much of the changes that you mentioned with the new blood in particular, are they people that Republicans and Trump have managed to get into the system based upon the big lie?
Well, that's the concern from some quarters, and I actually have some recent research also with my co-author in this report, Nan Thompson, where when we look at concerns that a lot of election officials are elected, and a lot of them are elected with party labels, and they come in, of course, with their own ideologies, and so in that piece, which we published in American Political Science Review last year, we were looking at do election officials advantage their party. And this is another going back 20 years. And the conclusion for that was actually fairly reassuring for America's democracy. We found that Republicans and Democrats, election officials in office, administer elections very similarly. Now, what the question is, will the new wave of election officials do things differently? And that is, of course, a concern. But I think the bigger concern with election officials leaving is that. Those who take their place, will they have the experience necessary? Will they be able to be brought up to speed to successfully administer elections without too many mistakes or mishaps? And I think this is something that we're very concerned about. There are mistakes in any elections, especially with so many voters, so many different jurisdictions. There are approximately 8,000 different election jurisdictions in the US. And what we saw 4 years ago is that these little mistakes were blown up into a narrative that the election was fraudulent. And so we're confident that most election officials are in there to because they care about it, because they want to administer elections impartially. And I also want to mention there are bipartisan safeguards throughout the system in the poll workers that are selected in those certifying the election results and those actually counting the ballots. But we're concerned that if so many election officials are leaving and new people are taking their place, are there going to be more mistakes, which then can be blown up into a greater Stop the Steal narrative in 2024?
Well, aren't they in many states, though, the election processes themselves are getting more complicated because of election restriction laws that are being passed in state legislatures? An example being North Carolina, where you've got to submit all kinds of documents to vote now. You've got to have Xeroxes of your address, bills, your driver's license. I'm not even sure that your birth certificate is included. Is that a factor? In other words, if you're having new people come in, and even if they're not partisan, their job's more complicated because of the election restriction laws that Republican state legislatures are passing.
Absolutely. And that's a concern now. It's also been a concern over the past several decades. You mentioned North Carolina requiring voter identification. Many other states have imposed new restrictions on voting. And a lot of states are changing their election code. And it's simply difficult for these election officials, under-resourced as they are, to keep up with all of these law changes. And virtually every state has vastly expanded their election codes over the last 20 years. And it's not just changes to election law, but the job itself has gotten much more complex, much harder. Now they have to be worried about cybersecurity threats from Russia and China. They have to deal with new complex technology to register voters, to efficiently count so many votes. So the job has gotten harder. And I think one of the concerns is many states are moving to criminalize mistakes. And so election officials are worried that they'll be legally liable for simple mistakes. And the bottom line is, and one of the main recommendations we make in this report is that if we want highly qualified, dedicated officials running free and fair elections, we have to pay them adequately to do it. We don't think compensation has kept up with the demands of the job. And when you add threats and harassment, it's very easy to see why so many election officials are leaving in the last few years.
Well, didn't the new election laws passed in North Carolina and Georgia, don't they criminalize mistakes on the part of election officials? They get something like 5 years in jail or something?
Yes, that is the worry. And I do want to mention some states have instituted new protections for election officials. You know, states are moving in the other direction. They've said, you know, these threats and harassment are significant. But of course, yeah, some states, the legal environment has gotten quite dicey. Not to mention that some states are transferring election authority to other actors. And then some laws that we've seen passed recently worried that they give poll watchers, poll observers, too much influence to disrupt the voting process. So poll watchers are, of course, an essential part of any democratic process. The idea that any person from a party can observe the process and make sure it's everything's being conducted above board. But the worry is that the Stop the Steal folks are going to come and disrupt the process, and election officials won't be able to do much because of these new laws. So that is a concern as well.
But some of these Stop the Steal vigilante types, we already saw in the last election in Arizona, armed people standing by election drop-off boxes, etc. Is that a growing threat? Not just that the election observers on the Stop the Steal side are zealous, they may well be armed.
Well, that's a concern. And I mean, that's, I think, part and parcel with the threats and harassment that have seemed to increase facing election officials, some of which has been referred to the FBI. It's an important balance to make, where we want to be concerned about these threats, but we also want to be clear that election officials do seem to be equipped to run free and fair elections. A large portion of the report we focus on, do the election officials coming in have the proper experience to successfully run elections? And we find that incoming officials on average have about 8 years of experience running elections. And so that's very valuable. And then especially in large jurisdictions, where it seems like a lot of the threats and harassment are focused on large jurisdictions, we find that election officials in populous jurisdictions are leaving almost at a 50% rate. But in those jurisdictions, the new officials coming in have on average 11 years of experience. So those are all positive indicators that election officials, that even though a lot of them are going to be new, they are going to bring the proper competencies. But of course, it is a broader environment where those who care about democracy are worried that what happened in 2020 may repeat. And even if it doesn't repeat, that those who are being emboldened by the lies of a Stop the Steal then take action to disrupt the election or deter people from voting, which could change the election results.
So you were saying earlier, Joshua, that both Democratic and Republican election officials do their job in a nonpartisan way. And that's been a kind of tradition in spite of the polarized nature of our politics, which are increasingly, of course, being polarized. And as you mentioned, there's a fear that if Donald Trump loses this election coming up in November, he'll do the same as he did last time. But this time he could even bring in the militias that answer to his call. But when you talk to these election officials, and you've clearly talked to 18,644 of them for your report, which goes across 6,290 jurisdictions in all 50 states, just at a human level, what are they telling you about this different environment? Because it never used to be going to vote was a civic duty and actually quite a pleasant one. You run into people that you know, perhaps, and, you know, everybody's really nice to you. At least that's been my experience. But then you've got, if you're going to have people shouting and carrying on and carrying and armed to the teeth outside elections, it's a whole different atmosphere. And it's clearly a result of the arrival of Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans, who, you know, have brought all of this hatred and militancy. So what are you hearing at the human level from these election workers who, for the first time, it seems, in America's history, maybe going back earlier to the early days, maybe things were pretty raucous then. But I don't think, I think this is a new environment, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm hearing a couple different things. I think the first thing to emphasize is a lot of election officials are saying that, you know, they're generally worried about the new environment, but they haven't personally experienced the threats and harassment. Things have run smoothly in their jurisdictions. They're preparing for the presidential election as we speak, and they're ready to run free and fair elections. But we do hear from a significant minority, and as I said, especially in populous jurisdictions, that these officials are experiencing an unprecedented wave of hostility and even death threats. And it is, of course, it takes a human toll. And more of them are leaving now as a result. It's harder to recruit people who care about democracy. And it's making their job harder. And so I think part of the takeaway of this report is that this isn't a new issue. Yes, there's novel concerns over the last few years, especially after 2020. But election officials have been leaving at higher rates for the past 20 years. Almost every year, we've seen a steady increase in the percent of election officials who are throwing in the towel. And I think part of it comes to a more difficult partisan environment, which hasn't just been the past 4 years, but really the past several decades, where in the wake of 2000, and then we go to the 2010s, both parties, the partisan environment has become increasingly fraught, and we see a wave of election lawsuits every single year. And then part of it are just the job is getting more and more difficult. You mentioned the election laws. We talked a little bit about that. And the compensation just hasn't kept up. So the result is a lot of election officials are leaving, and definitely this is a concern and something that needs to be addressed. But on the other side, we do want to emphasize those election officials, by and large, care about what they're doing. They realize that what they do is essential to America's democracy, and they're still doing their job, even in the wake of the threats and harassment and the other challenges that have emerged over the past couple decades.
Well, Joshua Farrar, thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And I've been speaking with Joshua Farrar, who's a PhD candidate in political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, who researches American politics, methods, racial and ethnic politics, and comparative politics. He's the co-author of a new report at UCLA and the Bipartisan Policy Center, Election Official Turnover Rates from 2000 to 2024. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.